Welcome back to Current State on WKAR. There have been some frayed nerves in Meridian Township today, this morning, after a gunshot earlier this morning. And for a while, Meridian Township police were conducting a search for a man possibly connected to the shooting. And schools near Cornell and Hazlitt Roads were on lockdown. They may still be on lockdown here at 9:07 Eastern Daylight Time, a.m. But police now, we're now learning that Meridian Township Police expect that that lockdown to be lifted shortly. According to the WLNS website, Meridian Township Police have halted the search for that suspect that they say may have been connected to a shot being fired early this morning. And hopefully by the time our noon and 6 p.m. listeners are hearing this on Current State, that situation will have been got back to normal, and we will know what we need to know. In July, the Michigan Supreme Court voted 5-2 to strike down parts of state law regarding sentencing guidelines, making them advisory rather than mandatory. Judges will now decide on a minimum amount of prison sentence range. The One Book, One Community program in East Lansing and at MSU this year is focusing on prison issues, such as the death penalty and life sentences for young offenders. Tonight, there will be a panel discussion on mandatory minimum sentencing requirements. That forum starts at 7 o'clock at the Broad Art Museum in East Lansing. The program will be moderated by one of our next guests. Hugh Clark Jr. is a 54A District Court judge in Lansing. He joins us now. Welcome to Current State, Judge Clark.
Good morning. Thank you.
And we're also joined by MSU Criminal Justice Professor Christopher Smith, who is one of the panelists discussing mandatory minimum sentences this evening. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Judge Clark, what does it mean to a district court judge, such as yourself, to have the Michigan Supreme Court give you more leeway in sentencing?
Well, as a district court judge, that doesn't really affect us because most of our sentences, we see very few mandatorily required sentences in the district court. This has a larger effect on circuit judges who are dealing with felony offenses. Now, I will say we have one or two under local ordinance, but this decision is, it's a continuation of the conversation and discussion that's gone on since their initial inception, the sentencing guidelines by the state of Michigan back in the mid to late 90s. Is it advisory? Then it becomes mandatory. I say now we're back to advisory, and I certainly, as a practitioner for over 30 plus years, you know, I had to deal with this issue.
Well, Chris Smith, what are the problems that have been discussed here regarding mandatory minimums that are a part of this conversation?
I think there are several concerns. One is when you have mandatory minimums, you'll have individual cases that I think people throughout society are shocked and have a consensus view that that's too much punishment for, say, a first offender for a nonviolent offense. But mandatory minimums really reflect the politics of the justice system. And when you have elected officials and legislatures looking at an intractable problem like crime, and they feel, you know, what can I do about this? The public often wants to hear that they're doing something about it. And the easiest thing to do is to keep making punishments more and more severe. And given that the public often doesn't have an accurate sense of what's going on with crime in society, for example, people have this perception very often that it's going up and up and up. And in fact, it's been cut in half nationwide violent crime in the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. So it's a politics based on belief and symbolism and is not necessarily connected to what one would say is good evidence-based policy.
Mm. Anything to add to that, Judge Clark?
I don't disagree with that. I think that's been the genesis of this. Is, you know, as our country evolves, as years go by, it's almost like a pendulum that goes back and forth, and people get to a point where they're like, well, we're sick and tired of crime, and lock them up. We got to have tougher sentences. We have to have longer sentences. They have to serve the actual minimum of the sentence. And you know, it's understandable how people get to that point, but the real problem with that is twofold. A, does that help? And, you know, when you're putting them in an environment where they're with other folk of similar crimes, and they're learning more about it, and you're hardening the criminal. But number two, and more importantly, is the cost. And I think people are beginning to realize that with these mandatory minimums, that people aren't getting out on parole at any shorter period of time, and it costs more to lock people up, and they have them locked up longer. So now you have to build more prisons. And if you build more prisons, they're going to jail more people or imprison them. And it just kind of keeps going. The cycle keeps going. And so to the extent that now I think Michigan's back to talking about it, they just opened or privatized a prison over in Lake County, if I'm not mistaken, for juvenile offenders. And, you know, we see some of the issues when you privatize services within the prison industry, and we've just seen that with the food service.
Mm-hmm. Can we trace this to the, I'm led to believe we can trace a lot of this to the drug challenges going back to the 1980s and maybe the 1990s. Chris Smith, is that your understanding? Is that the genesis maybe of this challenge?
Well, it's partly drug challenges, but it's also largely perceptions about drug challenges, because we often have frightening stories about, you know, the crack epidemic or what have you, and how do we react to those kinds of things? And sort of thinking about tying this to the one book business, you know, the racial impact of what has happened with sentencing has been somewhat staggering. And you can look at the rhetoric related to the so-called crack epidemic, where the response was, let's make sentences mandatory and longer, and compare that to the rhetoric of the meth epidemic, which is primarily white users, and you see all this talk about we have to invest in treatment programs. And you can also get a sense that underneath this, we see some racial assumptions and disparate treatment that impacts where we've gone.
MSU Criminal Justice Professor Chris Smith, along with District Court Judge Hugh Clark Jr., are our guests today on Current State. Tonight, they are both on a panel talking about mandatory minimum prison sentences at MSU's Broad Art Museum. We've had members of the Michigan Prosecutors Association and members of the law enforcement community on this program. And as you might expect, they offer up a combination of caution, if not resistance, to some of these proposals. Have you heard valid points raised from prosecutors and members of law enforcement regarding minimum sentences and the caution that maybe we ought to exercise moving forward?
Well, I can say from my experience as a practicing criminal defense attorney, clearly law enforcement is in the arrest them, lock them up mode, okay, for a lot of offenses. Because, you know, look, there's some offenses that, you know, you really could give some people a warning on. But I think if we go back to what this decision in Michigan, People versus Lockridge, it's a 2015 decision, as you pointed out. What the court said there, and the issue they had, is that Michigan has this legislatively enacted sentencing scheme, and it requires the trial court to make certain findings after the jury has reached its decision at sentencing, that they use in determining the past history and the circumstances of the crime. Now, this some of this information may or may not, and generally has not gone in front of the jury. And using this information to score the defendant's mandatory minimum sentencing range, okay, they found violated the Sixth Amendment rights of the defendant, right to have counsel. Because, again, these factors are being determined, and it may be beyond anything admitted by the defendant or found by the jury. Mm. And there's a U.S. Supreme Court case, Alien versus United States, that they followed that has led this. So that's why we have that in Michigan. So that's why they say now the guidelines are advisory. They were mandatory as to, well, yeah, let me just break it down. In Michigan, we have what's called indeterminate sentencing. If you're convicted, say, of a larceny building, that's a 10-year maximum. When you're sentenced, the judge has to impose on the top end the maximum. He's required by statute. It is that mandatory minimum where the issue comes in that they have to impose based on the guidelines. So after the judge scores you, you fit, they look at a grid and see where you are. So if your mandatory minimum range is between 36 or 42 months, your minimum sentence has to be within that range. Now, the judge can go up or down for substantial and compelling reasons, but they have to state that on the record. So your sentence might end up on the low end at being 3 years to 10, but that three is a mandatory minimum. You must serve the three before you're eligible for parole consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other than that, you know, I don't believe this is going to affect mandatory minimums like a felony firearm, which is a mandatory minimum 2 years in prison, and you serve that time before you serve any time for the underlying crime. So if you committed a robbery and you got convicted of armed robbery and felony firearm, you'll do the 2 years flat on the felony firearm, then you start the armed robbery sentence. It won't have any effect on people convicted of first degree or felony murder, because that's a mandatory life in prison, no probation, no parole. So for those people who, you know, I won't say fans of that or support that theory, that stays. It's just this sentencing on this mandatory minimum end, which the judges is now, it's not mandatory. I mean, it's back in flux. And it's going to take, I think, a while for judges to get a good handle on it and figure it out. So I'd say you're going to see a little more litigation on this.
I want to ask both of you what you whether you think race has played a role in mandatory minimum sentencing. Chris Smith?
I mean, we can identify an impact with respect to looking at drug sentencing. You know, in the federal realm where crack, cocaine had these staggeringly long sentences, but powder cocaine was much, much less, even for the same amount of the same substance. And you had situations, there was a case in the Supreme Court where the Los Angeles U.S. attorney was only prosecuting black defendants for crack cocaine, never a white defendant. Mm-hmm. And you end up then with really disparate effects. Now, is that, I mean, to say it's a conscious effort, I mean, I don't think you want to go there without proof. But, you know, there's a lot of implicit bias in society. There's a lot of stereotyping that goes on in society. And it certainly seems to reflect and exacerbate those kinds of things.
Judge Clark is an African-American. I've got to ask your perspective on that.
Oh, I don't. Well, be I African-American or not, I think at the end of the day, you cannot exclude race. You cannot exclude socioeconomic background, which would include persons of all races. In, I think, the reason that they came out in Michigan and perhaps other states enacted mandatory sentencing, at least these guidelines, because it was their effort. It was they were looking to try and standardize sentencings across the state. Clearly, you know, if you have someone from an inner city who's charged with one offense and has a similar background, excuse me, as someone of a different ethnic race from a highly affluent community, a lot of times those sentences were different.
Mm.
Particularly, you know, again, I'm not talking about the robberies or the criminal sexual assaults or homicide cases, but we're looking at larcenies or drug cases, possessory cases. Clearly, there was a difference.
You've practiced law for a good long time. You've served on the bench for some number of years. I have to ask, have your attitudes changed? Was there a time in your career when you were, quote, tougher on crime than you are today? Have your views changed?
Well, I wouldn't say my views have changed. I mean, there are a lot of reasons that I don't know that any of them are really good reasons why you would want to be a criminal or go out and commit a criminal offense. But I see more of it now, and I get, you know, I have more of a understanding of how people find themselves in that situation. But still, as a sitting judge, my job is to, I look at it as I have to be fair. I'm not going to treat anybody any different than I treat anybody else. And I pride myself on that, and I think not only if you ask lawyers, but the one feedback I get from people who've been in my courtroom through as defendants, I hear this from people, is that they all say, you know what, he sent me to jail, or he was rough on me, but he was fair, okay? And I just go right down the line with that. It doesn't matter your ethnic background, doesn't matter socioeconomic, doesn't matter your gender. I'm going to be fair, and I'm going to treat everybody similarly situated the same way.
We have less than a minute, but I want to get this out there. Another impending legal development. Next month, Michigan's Indigent Defense Commission will vote on whether to recommend stricter standards regarding indigent defense, basically strengthening standards involving the defense of poor people who are accused of crimes here in Michigan. How closely are you following this, Judge Clark, and what do you make of it? Are reforms necessary?
Well, what you need, what you really don't have, is a training. There's no training for lawyers coming out, going into practice, who want to do criminal defense work. A lot of times what we're seeing now, you have three, four lawyers, they get together, they put a firm together. None of them have ever practiced. And there's not a lot of people out there to mentor them. I think it's a good idea for training. I think the rough part's going to come when you look at how you're going to implement funding for that statewide when, and here's my little plug, you know, we can't get funding done to fix the roads. So that's going to be an issue. I think that's going to be how do we fund
clearly, that is in circulation. We want to thank both of our guests. Again, tonight's forum on mandatory minimum sentences starts at 7 p.m. at MSU's Broad Art Museum. Judge Hugh Clark, Jr., MSU Criminal Justice Professor Chris Smith, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
State three times daily on WKAR radio, twice on 90.5 FM, and every day at noon, every weekday at noon on AM 870. Most Michiganders know the Straits of Mackinac from driving over them, not swimming across them. But last week, one local couple got up close and personal with the cold lake waters when they participated in the Mighty Max Swim, an annual swim across the Straits that attracted 84 intrepid participants. This year, Samantha and Todd Kennedy of East Lansing join me to tell us what the experience was like. Welcome to Current State.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Have you warmed up yet?
I think so. Okay. We're on thawed.
Okay. 25 minutes at 375, and you're about back to normal.
About,
right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank goodness for wetsuits.
I tell you, I am not worthy. I am so impressed with you and the 82 others that apparently jumped into the Straits. When did you know you really wanted to do this?
We had a lot of friends really get us involved, and part of it is while Mackinac is always a special place for both of us. We actually got engaged on the island.
Oh.
And we do a couple triathlons up there, and you always look at the bridge and always kind of think what a cool event it would be, or if you ever had the opportunity to swim across it. So it didn't take much nudging when we found out this was going on to really get us on board. So
were either of you reluctant? I mean, did one of you say, "Oh, come on, we ought to do this"?
And I think I was more gung ho about it than
you. Oh, really?
He was.
I get
really
dragged along on many things in this relationship, but it was an absolute blast.
What to talk to us about the physical qualifications here too? I know you're both triathletes, so you're presumably pretty comfortable and pretty adept in the water. Were you? I mean, 4 miles for a serious swimmer?
It was 5 miles if you can go straight
five
across.
Miles.
Nobody
miles.
Was able to
Sorry.
Because the current was so strong that day. So
yeah.
We went 6 miles, which was actually on the lower end for people that day.
People were blown so far off course that they had
yeah.
to swim that much farther?
Some yeah. people went 9 miles, I believe.
I think it was definitely upwards of 8. prolonged their event. prolonged the fun.
How did you prepare for the currents and the wind? How did you prepare for these conditions? Can't you prepare for these?
I don't think we necessarily did, except for the fact that we race triathlons all the time, which are always in open water. And we have raced up there once a year for the past many years. So I guess that's kind of how we prepared.
Definitely with the triathlon training, we already had a decent amount of base mile or base yardage in, so it definitely gave us a foot up on getting really ready for it as opposed to coming from nothing. But nothing really can quite prepare you from getting all the way out there in the water with, you know, 4, 3, 4, 5 foot waves at times.
For sure. Those were dealing with 5 foot waves.
That's what we heard.
Definitely 4. It was a new experience for me. I've swam in some pretty rough water, and that one takes the cake.
Mm-hmm. What was it like, Samantha, dipping your toe in the water just as you were getting started? Were you more anxious than on a typical long swim?
When we first started, it was more a lot of excitement that we were finally getting started because it was a little over a year leading up to this. Mm. So at the very beginning, it was a lot of excitement and the water was still relatively calm. I don't think I started to get more anxious until I could no longer see the bottom.
Yes. That will do a trick on your psychology, I would imagine.
Yeah.
What about you, Todd?
Definitely. It's similar to Samantha. Getting started actually was probably the most fun part. A lot of the apprehension was the days and weeks and even months leading up to it, because the swim was only half the journey, really, because the event itself being a great fundraising event for Habitat for Humanity, raising money through all the events. So actually, the start of the swim was probably the most fun. Similar to Sam, as soon as you hit the first tower and the waves started to get nuts, that's when the nerves started to set in, actually.
Todd and Samantha Kennedy of East Lansing are here to tell us about participating in the Mighty Max Swim last week. This is the annual swim across the Straits that attracted the Kennedys and 82 other participants here this year. What was the water temperature?
It was about 67 degrees,
ooh,
which is pretty chilly, but with a wetsuit, it was pretty manageable. Mm-hmm.
You know, as demanding as the swim itself was, I keep thinking that enormous bridge right there, it kind of makes me jumpy, almost as if the whole thing might come crashing down on you while you're swimming across the Mackinac Straits. Was the bridge a distraction? Was it a preoccupation in any way?
Only in the way that we got blown fairly far to the east. So I think if the bridge had fallen down, we all would have been well clear. But in that, when you were trying to get to the other side, because the bridge was a little far off, it seemed like you were never moving.
Todd, how often do you train? How often are you in the water? How often are you running? That kind of thing.
Definitely 3 times a week for swimming, and then hopefully at least that much running as well. But some days, depending on how motivated I am, usually about 3 times a week, though.
Back to the swim, how long did it take to swim the, what'd you say, 6 miles?
6 miles for us, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the boys in my group were pretty fast. So Todd and some of his friends finished in 2 hours and 50 minutes. Took me a little bit longer. I finished in about 3 hours.
What was the single most challenging aspect of this?
Ooh, it was definitely in the middle section with at least of the swim itself, the waves in the middle where it was at its deepest point, when you just felt like you were on an endless treadmill of water, because it was almost mentally as tough as it was physically, because you're battling the water, you're battling the waves and the current and the thought of you're never going to reach the other side. That was probably the toughest part.
What was staying warm a challenge, Samantha?
Staying warm wasn't really a challenge. We're used to relatively cool water, and we had full sleeve wetsuits. So once you got going, just your own swimming and trying to get across was keeping us warm enough. And with the wetsuits, we were definitely warm enough.
Samantha and Todd Kennedy are here to talk to us about swimming the Mackinac Straits last week in the Mighty Max Swim. How does this compare, Todd, with previous events that you've participated in? Is this some kind of bigger accomplishment, or how does it rate?
Definitely, it's bigger in a different way, because Samantha and I, we do lots of triathlons, of course, and the swims are always much smaller, really more for personal enjoyment. This event was more special in that there was a bigger cause behind it, raising all the money for Habitat for Humanity, doing something that was really a once-in-a-lifetime experience. We'll see if it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I'll definitely be taking the bridge for the next couple of years. But so in its own right, it was special, and probably one of the more special things I've been able to do compared to the other events that I do.
Talk to us about what you do when you're not accomplishing outstanding athletic feats here. Samantha, what do you do?
Well, in addition to competing as a professional triathlete this year, I work as a psychiatry resident for Michigan State.
Mm. So you are a professional triathlete. How does that work? You have sponsors.
Yep, I have sponsors, and I'm on a team. And basically, you have to finish in a certain spot at a certain race. There's all sorts of crazy rules, and then they give you a little plastic card that says elite on it.
How about that? Are you professional as well, Todd?
Oh, no. I just train enough to try stay ahead of Sam. I work as a pharmacist in the East Lansing area, so that takes a lot of my time. But yeah, no, I'm not a professional triathlete. I do my best though.
I have to ask. I mean, the swim coincided with the walk over the bridge. Were you conscious of the walkers up on the bridge? Could you hear them or see them?
I could see them.
By any chance?
I was a little envious.
Probably couldn't hear them.
Maybe at the start when we were closer to the bridge. We got blown away by the time we got to the middle, so you lost sight of them. But I definitely saw them walking at first, and I was like, well, that was maybe a better idea on a day like today. But
I read that there's a security zone around the bridge that's enforced by Homeland Security, and that the route had to be planned in such a way that the current wouldn't pull swimmers too close to it. Did that impact you, or were you aware of that?
Yes, they had it. Our event coordinators, they did a good job of showing all the different ways we could swim. They had about three or four different routes we could have taken, and we had the Coast Guard shuttling us across, but also keeping us out of that 450 feet zone from the bridge, which is actually pretty close when you get to it. But yes, they kept us safe, but also kept us a decent away from the bridge as well.
You going to do this again? Do you expect to participate in the Mighty Max swim, Samantha?
It's on the radar, definitely. We really loved raising money and holding the events that we did to raise the money for it, but it was definitely time-consuming, so we may need a few years off to recover.
Understood. Todd, what about you?
Oh, same. Same with Samantha. I mean, I think we both had the desire to do it again. We might need a breather.
Going to do it faster.
Yeah, do it a little bit faster. We'll cross our fingers for good weather for the next time we do it, for sure.
Understood. We want to thank our intrepid swimmers and triathletes from East Lansing. Samantha and Todd Kennedy have been talking about swimming the Mackinac Straits last week and the Mighty Max Swim for Habitat for Humanity. Congratulations on your accomplishment. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Coming up on Current State, it's been nearly a week since the dramatic resignation of embattled Tea Party Republican State Rep Todd Courser. Courser's under criminal investigation by the Michigan State Police on allegations he misused taxpayer funds to cover up an affair with a fellow legislator. Todd Courser sat down with Michigan Public Television's Tim Skubick and other Capitol reporters yesterday. We'll hear that interview coming up. Also, the Lansing Symphony Orchestra welcomes piano master Ralph Votopek to the stage to open its 86th season on Friday night. He'll be playing Gershwin, and Current State's Melissa Benmark talks with LSO conductor Timothy Muffet about the program. That and more after the break. There are the bluesy riffs of Hatchet Man and the Frog, our guests here in Studio S back in March. Tomorrow, on our Live Music Friday, we welcome Mike Scorry of the band Root Doctor. Mike also performs solo in other configurations. Mike Scorry will test out our trusty Steinway here, sitting just a few feet away from me in Studio S. It's our next Live Music Friday. Tomorrow, we hope you can join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR. Thanks for listening. It's been almost a week since the dramatic middle-of-the-night resignation of embattled state rep Todd Courser. While it precluded Courser from becoming the first Michigan legislator expelled in 18 years, the Lapeer Republican is still the subject of a criminal investigation by the Michigan State Police. It's exploring whether he misused taxpayer funds as part of the cover-up of an affair with fellow legislator Cindy Gamrat. Yesterday, Todd Courser came to WKAR and opened up to Michigan Public Television's Tim Skubick and others about his resignation, the state police investigation, and his professional and political future. Reporters heard in the segment include Tim Skubick, Bill Ballinger of Inside Michigan Politics Newsletter, Gongwer News' Zach Gorchow, and MERS News' Kyle Malin. Malin first asked Todd Corser whether there was any aspect of the scandal that he thinks was overlooked.
I think inside of that, there are some steps that obviously went through this for me personally. And I think that what happened, I think, is that people, there was no recognition, or at least at this point, there's no recognition of the work that I did in the State House. So this whole thing, as we're walking towards the expulsion in my district, really, I think that they haven't been really exposed to the fact that we did some really good work, you know, as far as the voting and also for the things that
but
I sponsored.
Wasn't that irrelevant to your behavior?
I think it was. I mean, any time you're with reporters, this is kind of the unique thing, is that when you're with reporters, they ask you questions, and of course, if you answer the questions, it says you're not taking responsibility for the things that you've done. So it's difficult to answer the questions. I would just say, he's asking me what don't people know, is the really the very difficult private turmoil and the stress and struggle that that a family goes through that you see on television in sort of these moments, but that, you know, you have then the personally, you're walking through it, and it was an excruciating set of steps to walk
you
through.
You could run in the special election to replace yourself. Are you going to?
You've only asked me that. Is this the fourth time you've asked me that? It's the first time on camera.
I want an answer.
really, we're walking through just trying to do the healing right now. I know I have to make a decision if
48 hours.
I have not made a decision to
Do that. Have you heard from people in your district who say they think you've gotten a raw deal?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And the establishment wanted to get rid of you. And now's your chance to seek vindication. You could be the first person in Michigan history to resign your seat and come back and win a special election to succeed yourself.
Could. I mean, if you have to just walk those steps out. And I think right now it's really the personal side is there's a lot of healing that needs to happen. You know, I mean, look, I screwed up big. You know, there is very few people that have screwed up as much in their life as I've screwed up. And so, you know, when you look at that as far as a political story, that's great. But as a personal story, you have to make sure that those steps are right with you and your family.
So you're leaning not running.
I'm not leaning. You look at it every day, kind of like the expulsion.
Do you
decision.
Get up one morning and say, yep, I'm running. The next morning, I'm not?
I think that inside of that, it's happened so quickly. I'm just still trying to get up in the morning. How's that? So there's a lot of personal turmoil.
Does it depend a lot on how many other candidates run? If you get 7 or 8 candidates in the race and you've got a nucleus of support there and people that think you got the shaft, that could give you a plurality in a Republican primary.
I think it depends more on my family.
What's your family say? What do they say?
I can't really tell you that. I mean, she's my closest advisor on that, and we're walking through those steps. We're in counseling, obviously, together. And this story broke for the world right in the last few weeks. For our family, it broke back in May, and we've been walking through that as a couple. And there's nothing that's been more excruciating in my life than telling my wife and then telling my children just the real turmoil that's put them through. And so... You have to look at, it could be 8 candidates. There could be 82 candidates. I think the more important thing is making sure that it's the right decision for myself and my family.
You resigned at 3 a.m., just minutes before the House.
3:12.
I was going for just a
on September 11th, just, yes. Just to be...
Minutes before the House was going to vote on whether to expel you. Why didn't you just resign a month ago and spare your family, yourself, the whole state, all this anguish and drama?
Yeah, you know, I had assumed that I would be expelled. I had walked forward with that as sort of that gladiator in me going to the Coliseum floor just says I'm going to take it all the way. And because I didn't think there was grounds really for an expulsion, I felt the censure was appropriate. But given the historical historical examples of people who had been expelled, I felt that the conduct, although egregious on many levels, didn't really rise to the idea of being expelled. So as I was walking forward through that, it got to that night, and I could walk you through those steps. But personally, going through the 15 hours of session that day, I think it was really, I was sure I was going to be expelled. But yet, the conversation in my heart, I wasn't really talking to anybody, but the conversation in my heart was, is that the right decision? Am I personally doing that out of some sort of pride or arrogance that's there, you know, and really, really, honestly seeking the Lord in those steps and saying, is this the right decision or am I holding this for some other reason? And quite honestly, as I got down to the end, it was really just a sense that, okay, there was a giddiness in the room. They had walked through And, you know, and you're sitting there and they're going to exercise their most, their highest call, you know, their highest responsibility, these members, to expel another member. And the vast majority of them never even seen the evidence.
Do you think you were disrespected then by your fellow members?
I think that you have to take that response. I would not do that. I wouldn't expel another member, even in Brian Banks' situation or Virgil Smith's situation, without having read the evidence and really looking hard at it. I think you have to really take a look at that. I said the voter should decide. I really believe that the voter should decide.
Again, you're listening to an interview with former state rep Todd Corser here on Current State. You're hearing Mr. Corser in an exchange yesterday with state capitol reporters Tim Skubick, Kyle Malin, Bill Ballinger, and Zach Gorchow, taped at WKAR-TV. To begin the second segment of the interview, Corser is asked if he thinks he got a fair hearing from the special House committee that investigated the situation.
Well, I think up until the second day, they were doing a good job. My sense is that there should have been, obviously, the staffers called. They should have been put under oath. They should have actually gone through the evidentiary package of the 833 pages, because there's scant evidence of...
So on balance, it was an unfair hearing.
I would say on balance, it was an unfair hearing.
Wait a minute. You said under oath during those hearings that it was a fair process.
Good job, Zach. I'll tell you.
Just paying attention.
No, I would say inside of that, it was a fair process to that point. I'm assuming we're having another week or two of time where this stuff is all going to be laid out. I'm assuming the next day we're going to come in. There's going to be witnesses that are going to be questioned, that those steps are going to happen. So in my mind, I'm saying, have you received a fair hearing? Well, yeah, I've been able to tell you and have an opportunity to come before the committee. I'm assuming they're going to lay out the rest of their case. That, of course, didn't happen.
And are you contemplating any legal action on your part against anybody?
No, not at all.
Can you talk about what
time... I'm resting, Tim. I'm resting.
Now, on Facebook, you got pretty brutalized by folks in and without within and outside your district. Kind of talk about the amount of contact you got from your own constituents. How would you weigh that? Would you say it was 75% negative, 25% positive? What's kind of the balance on that?
I would say, it depended on the timing. Right at the beginning, it was overwhelmingly negative because of the emotional, I think, as it came out. I think it was justified. You know, I think when you attain that level of public trust and then your failure is so deep in that moment, I think that people are justified. I mean, you can understand sort of the disappointment and sort of the emotional attachment that was there. In my failure. But as time went on, what you had is you had a real turn among the people in the district, where people were now more encouraging, not encouraging necessarily in the way that you'd think it was encouraging, but just getting texts and emails and calls saying, and even letters just saying, and people stopping into the office and saying, hey, we're praying for you. We're praying for you and your family.
So would you say it got 50-50 near the end or not close?
I would say in the beginning, it was overwhelming that it was negative. And I would say, I don't know about 50-50, I'd have to look at it. But there was a lot of contact from within the district of people who were saying, you know, look, we're supporting you. We don't condone what happened and the behavior and your actions, but we do support you and your family.
Have the state police contacted you yet?
No, other than the information related to the texter, the situation with the extortion plot.
Do you want to talk to them?
I think at some point, you know, I don't know what really they're investigating at this point. So,
well, they're investigating criminal wrongdoing.
Yeah, I think they're going to look at the evidentiary package. Obviously, there's lawyers involved now, and we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. I can't really commit on that.
You can't commit to testifying before the state police. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't think I could do that here or explain that. I have to meet with legal counsel on what they're really.
Did the texter ever ask you for money or anything of value?
They alluded to it. There's actually a text in there that said, hey, I'm a little low on funds. Can you help me out? You know, as he gives you the, hey, I'm going to reveal pictures and video and audio, and Chad Livingood's going to get it all. And you shouldn't have let Ben and Keith go because they have a whole treasure trove of stuff on you. It really, when you're under that kind of pressure, when you went to the May 19th, which was a horrible decision when I look back, I'm thinking during that time, and as I've said, those are the actions of a desperate man making some really foolish decisions.
What about Representative Gamrat? Do you think her situation was any different than yours? The fact that she was expelled and you resigned, does that make anything different in your mind? What do you think?
I think the one unique feature inside of that, I'm just trying to visit with you. I used to do, when I would come here, it was always the political answer. You ask a question, I actually answer the answer of the what I want to say, not necessarily the question you're asking, but trying to, since I'm not a public figure, just trying to give you the answer. The difference, I think, inside of that is I wrote the email. If I had to go back and say what was the difference between her, those are not her words. They've been attributed to her, and she's been smeared with that. But the truth is, those are my words.
She conceded, or she said that it was fine to do that, though, right? I mean, what role did she play in that? Did she say, do this is a good idea, or did you just basically tell her, I'm going to do this? Is that okay?
It was more along those lines.
And she did not sign off.
She didn't sign off. She didn't know what had actually happened.
If you ran, could you win?
Well, I think that it just depends on...
What does your gut tell you?
I can't really... I don't even have that. I don't even have that. I think it really, what I would say is the voters should have been able to decide.
Winning is irrelevant to you right now, if I'm hearing your answer. It's all about family.
It is. I mean, I think that also, as far as the constituents, I think it's really, family is really, really important. But I think the constituents themselves should have had the opportunity.
And so if your spouse says don't run, you won't run?
That's correct.
So it's her veto power.
Yeah, I think it should be. I think we need to look at that and just say, what does that really look like?
If you don't run now, how about when the seat's up in another year?
It's day by day and hour by hour.
You know,
your emotions and mental stuff, and, you know, God has to really kind of move in my heart to deal with that.
Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Yeah, God bless you. Thank you.
Again, that was former State Rep Todd Corser, recorded yesterday at WKAR-TV by reporters Tim Skubik, Kyle Malin, Bill Ballinger, and Zach Gorchow. You can view the entire interview at WKAR.org. You're listening to Current State. The Lansing Symphony Orchestra starts a new season tomorrow night. Current State's Melissa Benmark joins us with more. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. It's an all George Gershwin concert, a couple of concertos and rhapsodies and some lesser known things. Like I usually do before Lansing Symphony concerts, I talked to conductor Timothy Muffet about the program. We'll hear from him in just a second. But first, I got to talk to pianist Ralph Fotopek, who's going to be pretty busy at this concert. I asked him what kind of physical preparation it takes for a concert like this.
Well, I would say it would equal about one Brahms concerto, or maybe, but not as much as Rachmaninoff Third. So actually in the Gershwin works, except for the Rhapsody in Blue, there's a lot of orchestral playing where I'm not playing at all. And anytime you're on stage playing, it's a mental challenge, but this is not a physical challenge. Playing Gershwin is not a physical challenge. And two of the works I've played since I was a teenager, so it goes back a long way.
What is your relationship to this composer?
I didn't know him.
in terms of playing his music.
He was born 2 years before. I was born 2 years after he died. So, but I heard Oscar Levant live once, and as a teenager, I listened to Levant's recording of the concerto and the Rhapsody in Blue, and I played it over and over and over, and somehow I always think that, in a sense, he was my mentor. He was, you know, the Gershwin pianist in the 40s and 50s, and he was a good friend of Gershwin. And he was not the greatest pianist in the world, but he was the greatest. He knew the style, and that was a big help for me. Because when I was in high school, I wanted to play Gershwin, but my teacher, who was very serious, considered Gershwin cheap, and actually forbade me to play any Gershwin. Not that there was a lot to play. I mean, really, he only wrote three preludes and a few little ditties that are not very important. But then, of course, there's the concerto, which is great, and the Rhapsody in Blue, and then two other works on the program, which are not as often heard and deserve to be heard.
So you were told you couldn't play Gershwin. Do you almost feel like you're getting away with something when you get to play it now?
No. Times have changed. But even in college, when I... At my first lesson, I told my teacher I had to play the Rhapsody in Blue in 6 weeks with the Milwaukee Pops. This was a result of winning a competition, and that the conductor was going to be Paul Whiteman. And he kind of rolled his eyes and said, well, I guess you'll have to play the Rhapsody in Blue. And he gave me one very good lesson, and that's the only lesson I've ever had from a teacher on Gershwin.
Wow.
But I've always loved the music. I loved the songs. And a little bit later, I... discovered there was such a thing as the Gershwin Songbook, which contained 18 short piano arrangements of some of his best songs, which I've recorded. And I wish there was more, actually, but that's it. Oh, thanks to Earl Wilde. He's made some marvelous transcriptions of Porgy and Bess and some of the songs, which are very difficult, and I've enjoyed playing those.
Talk about the second Rhapsody. Why do you think it's not performed as much as the other Gershwin works, even on this program?
Yeah, it's like saying, why isn't the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto No. 2 not performed? Because it's a wonderful piece, but it's just usurped by the Tchaikovsky No. 1. And so people hear the Rhapsody in Blue all the time, snatches of it, and they don't consider it. Maybe it doesn't have the memorable tunes, although it has one very beautiful tune, and he makes a lot of use out of a repeated note motif, which is stated right at the beginning. And it's, harmonically, I'd say it's a little more advanced than the concerto or the Rhapsody in Blue. And it's a later work, and Gershwin was already a master of orchestration. It's a fine piece. It's in little bits, you know. There's a tango, there's a march, there's whole tone passage. There's maybe one climax too many, but it's a fine piece. It's 15 minutes. I don't think it taxes the listener. It doesn't tax the pianist, really, because it's sometimes referred to as Second Rhapsody for Orchestra with Piano.
Well, Mr. Ralph Vodopek, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be here again.
Timothy Muffet, you don't usually have a program where all the works are by a single composer. Why now, and why Gershwin?
This all came about from a letter that Ralph sent me, and it was an actual letter, the kind that's delivered through the mail.
I remember those.
Yes, and he said, what would you think about this program? And, I mean, it's spectacular. The program has all of the elements of a successful concert program, in my mind. It has, first of all, a great potential for audience appeal and attracting an audience. We have that not only in the composer, but also in an artist like Ralph Vodopek. It has familiar works, works that a potential audience member is going to say, yeah, I'm familiar with that music. And then it also has works that are probably going to be a fresh experience for the audience member. Works that they have not heard live before, and probably many of them have not heard recorded before. And then also as an American orchestra, I think it's great when we play American music. That's just kind of a foundational element to our philosophy in the Lansing Symphony. So I feel like all of the stars are aligned here.
I feel with Gershwin sometimes like there are two Gershwins. There's the I Got Rhythm Gershwin, the very bouncy, outward Gershwin, and then in some of the slower passages, you know, perhaps of the concerto in F or that kind of thing, a real introspective. How do you reconcile right. those two parts of him?
Well, those are really great observations, because that's exactly, that is the expressive span of this composer, and that's also the expressive span of this concert. I mean, it touches on all sides of Gershwin. You know, I come at it very much the way I would come at Dvorak or Bartok or Kodály or any of these composers for whom the music of their homeland was the foundation for what they wrote. And it's interesting, you know, now we're coming at Gershwin now in the 21st century. And so this music no longer sounds like the popular music of today. In fact, it doesn't even sound like the jazz of today.
Right.
So we're seeing, I think we were, at least I am, able to kind of see Gershwin through a different perspective, a little bit more historically removed. So rather than feeling like this is pop music that has been put into concert format, this is just Gershwin writing concert music that was based on the music that was in the air in America during his time. So it makes that challenge that you brought up in your question way easier, because we are able to come at this music from a distance now.
Timothy Muffet, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And be aware, WKAR classical host Jody Knoll will host a preview conversation before the LSO's Gershwin program tomorrow night. That will be at 7:15 in the Jackson National Lounge. He'll be discussing the evening's pieces as well as interviewing guest pianist Ralph Votopek. More Votopek. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, low vaccination rates have been linked to outbreaks of measles and whooping cough last year in several Michigan counties. That prompted the state to require parents to talk to a health professional before seeking a so-called philosophical exemption. So, is it working? We'll discuss it with Ingham County Health Officer Linda Vail and Dr. Eden Wells, the Chief Medical Executive for the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Plus, it's a live music Friday. Keep in mind, Mike Scorey from the band Root Doctor will test out our trusty Steinway here in Studio S on a live music Friday. We hope you can join us tomorrow. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery was our director today. Thanks also to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, April Van Buren, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and Drew Hill. Current State can come straight to your smartphone every day. Just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. On social media, we're at KAR Current State on Twitter and on Facebook. At Current State from WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. We'll see you Friday on Current State.